There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
This week on the Mike Wise Show, our guest has been a trailblazer in so many areas that we could spend the whole show just reading her resume. She's standing by, so let's get to it. Darlene, do your thing.
The Mike Wise Show is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media. The Mike Wise Show is hosted by a guy who played basketball atrociously for Hawaii Pacific College, which forced him into journalism. And, oh yeah, he wrote about basketball for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and ESPN. He's also a wise ass, and so are many of his guests, right, Mike?
Thank you, Darlene. Ann Myers Drysdale is one of the most legendary athletes of all time. Her lists of firsts include, well, shoot, first player to be part of the U.S. national team while in high school, first woman to sign a contract with an NBA team, first female athlete in NCAA history to receive a four-year athletic scholarship, and the first Division I player, male or female, to record a quadruple-double. The first four-time All-American in women's basketball, the first female inductee into the UCLA Athletics Hall of Fame, and one of the first four UCLA players to have their number retired, along with Denise Carey and two guys you may have heard of, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Bill Walton. As a golfer, Annie was the first woman to compete in the Celebrity Golf Association Championship. That's just a partial list. Annie was inducted into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame in 1993, one of six Hall of Fames she has been inducted into. And she serves as an analyst for the Phoenix Suns broadcast and as a vice president for the Phoenix Mercury and Suns. Annie has also been involved with the Special Olympics for more than 30 years, which probably one of her most gratifying accomplishments. And I wasn't kidding, Ann Myers Drysdale, when I said your resume could take up an entire show. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. I'm excited to be here. Thank you for interviewing.
Yeah, no problem. It's great. I'm a little older, and I feel like the cranky old guy that's telling all the millennials about all these great players of their time. And you were one of them. I mean, you know, when I was growing up and watching these were some of the first games I saw on television was a view at UCLA and Cheryl Miller and the McGee twins at USC. Those were neat moments for me. Beyond the fact that I'm going to grill you on your life today, I'm a big fan. I just want to tell you that off the bat.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's hard to even know where to begin, but I know you were one of 11 children. I think you were number six, right in the middle. Did your will to compete start in the backyard?
Well, it absolutely started in the house. There's no question
about it. The playground, the dinner table.
My dad played basketball at Marquette, and my mom was in nursing school there. That's where they met. And then they moved out to San Diego when they got married. And he continued playing basketball, AAU basketball. But certainly having five older siblings and five younger siblings, we were always competing, whether it was sports, kick the can or Monopoly or board games or card games. We were all very competitive. But my sister Patty was the oldest of the 11. And for me, Patty was such a great role model. She was 8 years older than I was. But I saw her and all these women playing sports, softball, volleyball, basketball. And we had parents that were supportive of their daughters playing sports as much as their sons. And back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, that really wasn't, you know, heard of that much. Yeah. But certainly having parents that were supportive and encouraging for all their children to compete in sports was big.
When I finished my schooling at Fresno State, I got a job in the sports information department, and I was the aquatics SID. So I basically did swimming, water polo. And one of the people I became really friendly with, and she went on to a great career, kind of remind me a little bit, Terry McKeever. Are you familiar with her?
I know Terry, yeah.
Yeah, so Terry, Escondido girl. And she brought me home one week, and I met her entire family. They're all athletic. And of course, one of her dads was one of the famous McKeever twins. I thought of when I heard your story, I was like, she reminds me of, and I think, and they must know each other.
We've met along the way, you know, and certainly, you know, like I said, there were, you know, I was fortunate enough to come along when Title IX was passed, and I've been fortunate enough to be a product of that Title IX, which opened up so many doors for me. But in saying that, I knew things were capable because I saw all these women that my sister was competing against. And there were women playing sports a long time before I came along. And reading a book on Bae Didrikson's Zaharias when I was in fourth grade certainly opened up my eyes and gave me a dream to be an Olympian because of the kind of athlete she was and what she had accomplished.
Yeah, and I remember your late brother David was also a star player at UCLA. You both won national titles in basketball, David in 73 and 75, and I think you were in 78. Did you guys used to play one-on-one as kids?
We played a lot of different sports together, and so I was in between David, who's 2 years older than I was, and my brother Jeff, who's 2 years younger. So David was always pitting us against each other, but, you know, we'd ride our bikes or walk up to the playground. We never had a basket at our house, so we were always at the elementary school and so forth. So we'd take our basketball or our bats and balls and we'd play 500 in the street right in front of the house, or take a tennis racket and hit a tennis ball up against a wall somewhere. But we were always at the park and playing in pickup games. But, you know, one-on-one, David always beat me if we did play. But I always tried to be on his team. I didn't like sitting out on a team that I lost because I had to be next, but that next could have been three or four games down, you know, before you got back in again. So I was hoping to play on a winning team, which was usually David's teams.
He was, I think, 2 years older and he grew to 6'8". He was a very good player with the Bucks. I remember him.
Well, he was an All-American. I mean, he was, David Thompson went ahead of him in the 75 draft, but David was the number one draft pick with the Lakers. And 5 years later, you know, when he retired from playing with the Bucks, the Lakers came calling again. They wanted him to come play. But he had made his choice, and he ended up becoming an elementary school teacher, and made a big difference in a lot of children's lives. And certainly when we lost him 5 years ago of cancer, you know, it was really hard on the family.
Were you very close to him?
Well, we all were. I mean, all of us, you know, we either like each other or don't like each other, you know, it's just
your family.
Gatherings with the holidays and birthdays, and certainly a lot of celebrations with families together.
Yeah. Your father must have been really proud when he sort of was drafted by the Bucks because he played at Marquette, which is.
It was when David was drafted by the Lakers, he was in that trade with the four guys with Junior Bridgman, Brian Winters, and Elmore Smith and David that went to Milwaukee that brought Lou Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar back to Los Angeles. And we still had a lot of family in Milwaukee. My mom is from a large family of eight. My dad was an only child, but certainly we had a lot of relatives back there. So it was exciting for him to be back in Milwaukee.
Our producer, Bruce Bernstein, who you know is good friends with Nancy Lieberman, one of your contemporaries, she told Bruce that when she was a kid taking the subway from Far Rockaway, Queens to Rucker Park in Harlem, her mom used to be very concerned about safety. And Nancy told her, "Don't worry, Ma, I won't hurt any of the other players." Is that how you approach playing against guys?
No, I don't know. Nancy and I have certainly two different personalities in how we grew up. As being in the middle of 11 children, and Nancy has an older brother, but and certainly growing up in the kind of atmosphere she did, she was really out there. I mean, she was a go-getter. And not to say that I wasn't a go-getter. I was pretty shy. I was pretty introverted. Followed on the coattails of my brothers and my sister. And certainly I played seven sports in high school. And actually when I was growing up, the one sport that was available to us was in an organized situation was track and field and swimming. And I was not a good swimmer. My older sister, Kathy, swam and she was terrific. But I just reading this book on Bae Didrikson Zaharias and being in track and field, and I was a high jumper and a pentathlon. They didn't have the heptathlon yet. So I loved track and field. And I thought that that was my dream, was going to be the Olympics. And then as I got older and watching my sister Patty open up doors in volleyball and basketball and softball, seeing that I could play all these other sports, basketball obviously, you know, started to grow. And came along at the right time where they had the 76 Olympics. And Patty went to Cal State Fullerton and won a championship under Billy Moore. And they won the national championship in 1970. So Billy Moore was our Olympic coach in 76. And then Billy Moore, I had three different coaches at UCLA, and Billy Moore was my senior coach when we won the championship. So a lot of these tie-ins and so forth, but certainly knowing that I could go compete, but I was, yes, I was not a quitter. You know, I was pretty intense, but once I got home, I just, you know, I didn't talk to a lot of people. I was pretty shy and introverted, and a lot of people thought that I was kind of had my head up in the air because I didn't talk to them, but I couldn't look people in the eye.
What do you think that was about? You have a little social anxiety, or they don't diagnose those things back then, but I wonder in hindsight what they would have called it, you know?
Well, I was the middle of 11 children. I was a middle child, and right. You know, you get lost in the shuffle, and you talk about my dad, and he was proud of all of us, but I think all of us were, you know, vying for attention too. How good could we be? And sports happened to be our outlet, which was great because that many kids in the house was, I'm sure my mom was probably pulling her hair out. But, you know, they taught us discipline and hard work. Certainly my mom, you know, what she did around the house, whether it was laundry or cooking all day long and doing dishes and making lunches and dusting and just, I mean, having the house clean and so forth. And my dad going off to work, he worked for Sears for over 30 years. But, you know, we learned what it meant to work. And I think we took that into our athletics.
Women don't have 11 children anymore. That's that's just. I mean, she was pregnant most of your childhood, or at
Irish
least the
first good Irish Catholic woman.
I get okay, yeah. Contraception wasn't big in our family either. Unfortunately, no. I have three kids, and I'm thinking Elliot's my son. He's like six. I can't even imagine what it's like to be the middle of 11. I mean, talk about lost in the shuffle. Now I get it. I'm putting it all together a little bit. you have three kids, obviously, through your marriage to your late husband, Don Drysdale. Did, pardon my ignorance, did any of your kids turn out to be super athletes?
They all were. Yeah, I think they're superhuman beings. I think that's the only thing that I really value most is how kind they are to others and giving back. DJ Don Jr. was born on Don's birthday, which was not planned. He and Don had a daughter from his first marriage. But certainly with DJ coming along, it was hard not to name him Don Jr. being born on Don's birthday. And Don was working for the Chicago White Sox at the time with Jerry Reinsdorf and Eddie Einhorn. But DJ was born in Chicago. And and then Darren came along, and then our daughter Drew. And so we, they obviously they sports at a very early age. And whether you like sports or not, sports is such a great teaching tool about teamwork and how to get along with people, leadership, how to win, how to lose, what kind of attitude you have. You know, certainly your discipline and your dedication, your sacrifice that you have to do for others. And then you take that whether into your schoolwork or your business or your relationship with your parents or your siblings or girlfriends and boyfriends and so forth, your bosses. You've got to take those lessons that you learn. And Coach Wooden always say sports, you know, it doesn't build character. It reveals character. And go play golf with somebody. You really learn how somebody is when you go play golf with somebody.
You know, it's funny. That reminds me of when I went to when I was at the New York Times and Bill Bradley was coming out with his book, The Values of the Game. Yeah. And I had to ask him when we met for – I shouldn't admit this. I think it was one of the few lunches I was late for because I got the wrong French restaurant. And I remember reading in a thing anyway, Red Holtzman, his former coach for the Knicks, wrote always, he had this anecdote in the back book where it didn't matter whether what you were late for, you owed them $10 for being late. And so when I showed up at the restaurant, I go, I'm not going to even say I owe you $10 no matter what. And he laughed, but I had to ask him because he had this great piece you'll identify with this in the golf anecdote. He said you could learn more from playing 3-on-3 with someone in a half hour what their character's about, whether they give themselves to the good of the group, all the selfish, all the things about them, than you could sitting next to them in a cubicle in an office for a year. And I tend to believe that. It really, absolutely. You know, because right away you're forced to, you're in an ultimate teamwork situation, whether you're playing pickup or not. And yeah. And you gotta, you know, you have to be about more than yourself.
Well, and one of the things, Coach Wooden, again, David going through those, you know, I used to go watch practices when David was there, my freshman year, his senior year, but watching those practices, but Papa, Coach Wooden, which I call him Papa, had three rules. He said, don't be critical of your teammates. Be on time, because your time is valuable. Everybody's time is valuable. And don't be critical of your teammates or your others, because you make mistakes too. Everybody makes mistakes. And then the other one was your language, no cursing. And he felt when you cursed, you lost control of your emotions and you made poor decisions. And but if you take those three antidotes and take them outside of sports, it's exactly how you should live your life. Don't be critical of others. Be more concerned about yourself and what you're doing.
Hey, when we hear about all the stories about UCLA and the Wizard of Westwood and all those things, and it almost seems idyllic, and I'm sure there were unseemly things going on, like there are at any campus. But it must have been some of the special memories of your life. He seemed like the real deal in so many ways.
Well, he was, and even after he lost his his wife Nellie, I mean, he didn't want to live anymore, and he ended up living another 35 years. Lived to 99. And he still was sharp as he could be. I mean, he really was sharp. And but certainly watching those practices,
right at the end,
I was fortunate enough my freshman year, Mike, that my freshman year, Kenny Washington, who had played for Coach in those early championship years in 64, 65. So Wash, all the fundamentals, all those drills we did, Papa was doing with the guys, we were doing it with the women. And so Wash, my freshman year, really helped me a lot understanding the fundamentals, because I was a little bit of a hothead. I was very emotional and wanted, I was tough. I was this, you're going to do it my way. And he would just grind me down and said, no, this is the proper way to do it, the right way. And then my sophomore and junior year, I had Ellen Mosier, who was my coach, and I had played with her in AAU ball. And then Billy Moore ended up being the senior my senior year when we won the championship.
Coach Wooden, as you said, Nellie died long before he, I was thinking about you were only married to Don for what was it? 7 years before he passed.
Right.
Even today, I mean, all these years, some 30 years later, it must be a shock. Like that
I still miss
you didn't
him
get
every
more
day.
Time.
I miss him every day, and I think about him, and thankful that we have three beautiful children. And yes, they all played sports, growing up, and all the club teams, whether it was soccer or whether it was baseball or whether it was basketball or track and field, and they all played through high school, and then they've gone on to live their lives, which is great. So I'm very proud of them, and. Certainly they carry on their father's legacy, and Don really helped me in my life. And certainly I think that I was good for him in a lot of ways too, but I loved him very much. And not just because I really didn't know who he was growing up in Los Angeles. As kids, we're always out playing.
Right.
So games were not on TV. If you remember back in the 60s and 70s, you were lucky to have an NBA game on game during a Sunday. Same thing with a football game. And certainly baseball was not really on at all. It was interesting, though, when we lived in Chicago for a while, when my dad worked with Sears, a lot of the athletes back in the 50s and 60s worked for different companies in the off season to get, some kind of income. And so Don Larson worked for Sears. And so he and his wife became very dear friends of my mom and dad's. And we didn't know who Don Larson was, And so obviously, but I didn't follow baseball. My brothers were all big Giants fans. So, Willie Mays and Willie McCovey and Dimray Hart, Juan Marichal. And, I didn't know who Don Drysdale and Sandy Koufax and, Pee Wee Reese and all those guys were. But certainly after meeting Don, I think that that was probably maybe a little bit of an attention for him too, because I didn't know who he was. But certainly he knew who I was because I had just signed my contract with the Pacers. And so I had received a lot of exposure with the tryout, but I had gone on to play in the WBL, and that's what I was doing then.
Is that how you met him, through your parents, or your how did you meet
him? The superstars.
That's right. Which you won a bunch of times.
Yeah, he and Bob Uecker were the announcers, and Yuki had been on those commercials, right?
Right. Just a bit outside.
And he was on those beer commercials, and plus he was from Milwaukee. So my mom kind of knew who he was, and I knew him from the commercials. But I didn't really know who Don was. I mean, I know he'd been on some TV shows like the Brady Bunch and the Donna Reed and, you know, several other shows, but nobody really, you know. So
he was significantly, he robbed the cradle too. He robbed the cradle. Let's be honest. He was older than you.
Yeah.
Just like how much? I can't even remember.
Well, I guess you'll have to look at the years. You have to go online and
Google that. One of the most touching things I always remember when he passed, because not just because it was so sudden, but a friend of mine, he was a sports writer in Sacramento, and I worked at the same newspaper at him, Sacramento Union, and his name was Don Drysdale. Oh. Do you know of him or no?
No, I don't. No.
You don't know of, okay. So they called him Double D because Don Drysdale was one of these guys that the Don I met was, he ate himself out of the press room. He just got humongous. And now I think he's dropped the pounds, but he, before the most, one of the most touching tributes to your husband, I wish I could find it because the paper folded long ago. His first line was, and you'll love this. He said, all you have to know about was Don Drysdale owned the plate and I cleaned it. and then he went into how his namesake, the guy that, you know, that basically had the same name of his, gave him this identity crisis, but in a great way. And he had to explain his own life away every time because Don was so great. And I don't know, I just, you know, it made me think of that and all those days.
Well, his parents must have named him that for a reason.
Well, I know he was much younger. Yeah. And so do you think because you had such a great marriage in the years you did that was part of the reason why you didn't get remarried?
I was busy. I had three young children. The boys were 5 and 3 and our daughter was 3 months. My broadcasting career was just taking off. I was trying to figure out how I was going to raise the family and continue to work. Certainly it just, and that's why I look back and people ask me, how do you do it? Well, faith, family, and friends, that's for sure. But, my mom's faith has taught me to, really stay strong because she's lost 4 children and she's 95, and to lose 1 child, but she lost 4. And I just think, how does she do it every day? Certainly losing Don has been devastating for me, but again, whether it's through athletics or the way I was raised, you move forward. I don't think there's anybody that's really captured my attention, like Don did. And, but my focus certainly was on my children and raising them. Now that they're all grown, I'm still working, which I love. But the opportunity has never really presented itself either for me to get involved with anybody.
I don't mean to get so personal, but I just remember even in the years after he passed, every time I would see you talk about him, it was just a special time. And it just shows me why family is so important to you, beyond the fact that you grew up in a big one that was supportive. Like, well, they were around for you when that happened. That's good.
Well, they were. And I will say it's been special too, the Dodgers, you know, Peter O'Malley and, Donnie passed away up in Montreal, and the Dodgers took care of everything. And just last month we lost Tommy Lasorda. And Tommy was dear to the children, our children, because Tommy and Donnie were very close. They played ball in Montreal together. And so, you know, Tommy has said, you know, if some people have asked him like for years, hey, you know, who are you going to be excited to see when you go to heaven? And he said, Don Drysdale. And so in saying that, you know, it's just how close they were. And he said he'd always take care of us. And he did till the day he died. I mean, it just, you know, the Lasorda family has been very dear to us. The Dodgers is an organization, and the O'Malley family. Everybody's really been helpful in getting us through things, whether it's down to Vin Scully and Ross Porter or Jaime Harreen, the broadcasters, down to the players, Oral Hershiser and Brett Butler and Eric Karros and so forth. When after Don passed away, we'd go to the dugout, we'd go to batting practice, and the boys would go out on the field with the players. You know, so
you married into the Dodgers and they became your family, as if not just as a optics thing, but they've really been your family. I kind of knew a little bit about that, but that's so much more. Thank you. All the jadedness and all the snarkiness and all the things in the world now that make us skeptical of, as someone told me once, if your mother tells you she loves you, question that. Like that's how skeptical a journalism world we live in now. It makes me, it heartens me to know that that organizations still see that, whatever it is, the double bottom line, like caring about people, giving back, that you know, and the Dodgers clearly were that, have been that with you guys. Were you at that 88 game with Don, with Kirk Gibson?
We had just had my son DJ. We had just left the White Sox, and that was Don's first year back with the Dodgers. And so we had tickets to go, and I ended up staying home with the baby. And I had family members go. So they were out in right field, as a matter of fact, where those seats were, where he hit the home run. So it was exciting to watch it on TV.
Oh, I'd still be upset at my little one. I would have wanted to go to that game so badly. I guess I should get into your present day. I mean, the team you cover, the Phoenix Suns, is breaking through in a big way. I think leadership has been a key with Chris Paul on the court, Monty Williams, who I used to cover with the Knicks, on the bench. Monty's one of the most beloved members of the NBA family. What makes him such a great coach in your eyes?
Well, first of all, before I get to another family that I feel a part of, the Phoenix Suns and Mercury, I felt that, you know, during that transition with the Dodgers, also NBC really stepped in. And NBC doing 5 Olympics for them. And the first 6 years of the WNBA. So the NBC people really became a strong supporter of me and the children also. But that now being in Phoenix, I signed with them in 2007 as the general manager for the Phoenix Mercury. And we won a couple WNBA titles. And then they asked me to move to be a broadcaster and work in community service and so forth. And then we won another championship with the WNBA. So the Phoenix Mercury have 3, but you know, I think it's been a tough transition early on. Monty is finally there. You know, we've had some stability, and Devin Booker has had, you know, 6 different coaches in 6 years.
I didn't even think of that. That's almost like we had Jamal Crawford on not too long ago. The same thing where you wonder how different a person's career is. I'm just glad that he's experienced success now, finally.
He has stability. I think, you know, he's looking for stability, the organization was. And certainly it was a transition from Jerry Colangelo to Robert Sarver. And, you know, and Robert made a lot of changes. And so it took a while for it to kind of settle in. And James Jones as a general manager, bringing Monty in, certainly has been huge. And like you said, Monty is beloved throughout the, you know, the family of the NBA and the world of basketball. And certainly after he lost his wife and, you know, he's got 5 children now, he's remarried. He's got 6 children now too, but you know, I'm so happy for him. But he's one of the most humble and just faithful people that wants to do what's best for the others and to make these guys understand the team. Certainly, having Chris Paul there in the relationship that they had in New Orleans, you know, Chris's first year, Monty's last year, but it developed a relationship, and we brought in Jay Crowder, and you know, Frank Kaminsky's been back, and that's really helped. the bench a lot. Certainly the young guys are growing, Mikhail Bridges and Cam Johnson. Cam Payne is back healthy. Šarić is healthy again. So now we're getting a healthy team, because Monty is really, it's been a chess game for him to try and figure out, which most of the NBA teams has, whether it's been because of the COVID or because of injuries and so forth. So guys sitting out, and who are you going to play and who are you going to start and how many minutes you're going to give this person. So, but certainly Chris Paul, and I'd like to give Ricky Rubio some credit too from last year, that he really helped, I thought, Devin's game a lot. And now with Chris coming in, there's just this great rapport that the communication that these two have. And DeAndre Ayton is getting a good lesson. And he's just in his third year, and he's learning a lot. He still has a ways to go. But when you've got veterans and you've got this, you know, deep down, you see what Chris Paul has. But Devin has had that since day one. And Book has just been, he just keeps going up. And what's unfortunate, I will say, Mike, is that he gets so overlooked in the West for the All-Star game.
Oh.
But his numbers,
it's criminal. So it's worse than Bradley Beal in the East. I mean, I really believe you.
There's so many great guards in the West. So
yeah.
But in saying that, you know, Book is just, and that it drives him too.
Yeah, he's a special player. You got, and I like that. I always forget somebody like Rubio, like a guy who's been in the league for a while now, has really never had that moment where people say, oh, this guy's a great role player. This guy, and all of a sudden they're trying to prove something.
I think Ricky Rubio, the first time I saw him play, people don't remember, he was 17.
Yeah, that's true. The Wizards almost took him.
When he played for his national team for Spain, I mean, he was phenomenal.
Yeah.
Just phenomenal. But people, you know, it's others' expectations. Ricky's had a great career.
Why do I think that he hasn't had the greatest career? Just because of the teams he's been on?
Because people look at X's and O's. They only look at stats. They don't look at what's going on in somebody's life off the court and the things that are happening.
Well, I look at somebody like Jay Crowder. I remember the New York Times had a great story on Shane Battier years ago, and they said, like, this is a guy plus minus whatever team he's on, he's that intangible. Jay Crowder is one of those players to me. Like, he'll get that loose ball, he'll have that tip at the end of the game that you don't think that it means as much, but that was a championship, that was a winning play,
Rubio is that kind of guy too.
And
people forget this is a team sport.
Yeah.
It's not just one or two guys.
I forget that he's only 30 years old still. I mean, shoot. He's had a 12, 13 year career. And I always think, oh, Ruby's got to be 35. You're right. He came in at 17.
Well, and they keep talking about LeBron, and LeBron's waiting to play with his son. And I don't doubt that it'll happen. He'll play into his 40s. There's no reason he shouldn't, because his health has been good. But Kobe was 40. Kareem was 40. Robert Parrish was 40. Kid out of Atlanta, he was 40-something. So, I mean, Vince Carter, you know, 40. So there are guys that have played into their 40s. And I'm sure it's going to happen with LeBron.
Reggie Miller had the greatest quote about him lately in this sort of invisible hyperbole argument of, or who is the greatest player ever, which it's always, as John Thompson said before he died, whenever you do that, you're almost dismissing the other guy if you pick somebody. But he had a great way of saying it, and I don't know if you agree with it or not. He said, Michael Jordan, to me, was the player, if I'm a fan, I'm paying money more than anybody to see Michael Jordan. If I'm going to play short shirts and skins in a game, I want LeBron on my team in that empty gym, because he is going to win. He's going to either give me the ball, he's going to find a way to win the game for me. And he goes, and I thought, you know, whatever that says, that Jordan looks more graceful when he plays or whatever, or looks more spectacular, LeBron James is winning time no matter what. And they're both are competitive monsters.
Yeah. No, I see where he's coming from, but I don't agree. There, to me, there is no greatest of all time. who's the greatest running back? Who's the greatest quarterback? Who's the greatest pitcher? Who's the greatest hitter? Who's the great, you know? So yeah. Now it's a different game. You got a 3-point show. Who's the greatest 3-point shooter? So I'm saying that, and people are dismissing, to me, people dismiss Bill Russell. When I listen to these radio guys and TV guys, they dismiss Wilt Chamberlain. They dismiss Oscar Robertson, Walt Frazier, Jerry West. I mean, let's go down the list of guys, Julius, Johnny Hawkins. I mean, and nobody talks about Kobe. Okay. Where's Kobe?
Yeah. Kobe was, I look at Kobe as without
the Black
Kobe.
Mamba.
Yeah. The Black Mamba. LeBron. I mean, I'm sorry, Michael, in, you know, whatever, whatever invisible way, he passed the torch to Kobe. Kobe was the baton between Michael and LeBron, really.
Well, it took him a while, but then you got Shaq and you got, you know, there's so many other guys. I mean, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson really created things with TV. I mean, it's just a matter of what is going on today. And that's what radio and all this social media that they look at today. They don't know what happened yesterday. Charles Barkley was an unbelievable player, so he didn't win a championship. So neither did Karl Malone and John Stockton, but don't take away what they contributed to the game.
Yeah.
And because you don't win a championship. Sometimes the cards are just not there. Steve Nash. Tell me, Steve Nash. I mean, come on.
Well, they got let's be honest. I still think they got robbed out of that San Antonio series. That was so awful. They got robbed as much as the Kings got robbed in 2002 with the Lakers of going to the finals. There were a couple calls and a couple decisions made that to this day, had they been just a smattering different fork in the roads, the Sacramento Kings have a title. The Phoenix Suns become really the first move, pass, and shoot team since the Lakers and Celtics, you know, and obviously I think the Warriors became that team later, but they were that team that just made you excited to watch the game because of how Amari Stoudemire and the pick and pop with Nash, and they were just, God, they moved the ball, and Boris Diaw, they were so fun to watch.
Yeah, they were. Sean Marion.
Sean Marion. Oh, the Matrix. Oh, God.
Yeah.
I get you too. Like Patrick, having covered Patrick Ewing for years in New York, that was one of Pat Riley's still his greatest regret is he never put the player around him to get him the ring. But it's like somebody said to me the other day, you know, this whole ring thing, like, okay, I love Will Perdue. He's got three rings. Patrick's got none. Who's the better center in NBA history?
Steve Kerr. Steve Kerr.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
but it doesn't take, like somebody was talking about Nadal, the tennis player.
Yeah, Rafael Nadal.
Yeah, it's not based on what he's done on the tennis court. It's based on, you know, if he never won another championship, he has said, hey, if Djokic and what's his name from Sweden? Who's the guy? Who's the top guy?
Roger Federer.
Federer. Oh, yeah. Djokic, Federer, Nadal.
Right. But if Nadal, he has said, if he never wins another championship, and if I don't beat those guys, it doesn't make me any less of a tennis player.
Yeah.
And I know what I've achieved. And that's what Coach Wooden has always said. Be more concerned about yourself than others. You can't go by, you know, others are going to have their perception and say things, but that's not who you are. And what you do off the court, because those days are going to end, you know, as an athlete, they do end. And it's only a short period of your life. And then what do you do for the next 40 years? And that's when you make the impact.
Coach Wooden should have been my therapist. My therapist always tells me, take your own inventory. Don't take others. Concentrate. Like, that's what Coach Wooden was telling us.
Right. And
he probably stole it from Coach Wooden. He's making money off people.
Well, we didn't live in a social media time either. You know, today with social media, it just changes the playground a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, can you imagine? I mean, oh my gosh, they would have wrote who you were dating in college. They would have. The one thing about the LeBron story I'm always amazed by is he lived through an era of social media, and you know, and for all the whatever videos and things that people post that are either inaccurate or edited, he lived through that. The noise never got to him, which is incredible.
Yeah, but I love that the athletes have taken advantage of it, especially with social and racial injustice and gender injustice. Oh. I mean, a lot of these athletes have now. been able to take the platform. And the WNBA, I think, is a big part of that, too, because the women have always spoken out. But there's so much money to be made today with these athletes that you see that they're becoming owners of different teams and different leagues and so forth. Athletes of the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s didn't have that kind of money and to be able to invest. But so now there's a platform. And when you have the support of the people you work for, like the NBA and the WNBA, that supports their athletes to speak out about what is going wrong.
I think we've made it a hallmark of this show that whoever we have on, whether it's Garrett Temple or Roger Mason, people involved in different ways, and like it's and Jeannie Buss came on. It's like the whole notion of, I mean, you talk about a league that gets it, and a community really that gets it is I think there's something to be said for this. I always call it the renaissance of social conscience among athletes. I think it's incredible. I like using your platform for something other than winning and endorsements. And I think that that's what they're doing.
Well, it's been going on since the 50s. You know, really.
Well, there's been a couple drop-offs, though.
Whether you want to look at John Carlos and Tommy Smith.
Sure.
The Olympics, you know.
But I guess what I'm getting is there was a time when, they probably got more criticism than they deserved for it, but there was a time when, for instance, a Tiger Woods or Michael Jordan was they were very accommodating to their endorsers, and they didn't want to move, and they did not want to. And that, you know, that might have been the era, that might have been the time. But I like it that there's, and it's.
I think it's the people too. I think it's that individual.
You're right. You're right. That says something. Like that, I'd get you in trouble if I went into your owner's differing thoughts on some of those issues. But I think that overall, and the NBA, the WNBA players have been so awesome in their social justice crusades. Just really, I think, you know, have used their platform for something so much bigger than just basketball. And I love that.
And it's just not racial injustice, which is absolutely, right. There's no question there's systemic racism in this country and in this world, but also gender inequity. And whether it's equal pay or just how women are treated in general. And we can say that women's sports is, they've taken so many leaps and bounds and showing women's games on TV and so forth. And I don't think ESPN does as good a job as it could. I don't think a lot of the networks or give the women their just due. Certainly Serena Williams was a big name and with the Australian Open going on. And it's just the kind of questions that are asked of women rather than that are not asked of men. Certainly it's I think that women have really, because they are mothers and wives and even if they're single or in a partnership, and they are willing to speak out and put themselves on the line, whereas sometimes the guys aren't. I think Colin Kaepernick opened up the door for a lot of this to get going too.
I agree, and the one that I always hate, and it's such a, what do you call it, it's almost a sexist remark now, is I sometimes hear I don't like women's basketball. Then you don't like basketball. Like I don't look at never looked at the Washington Mystics when Elena Deladon and all her teammates were moving and passing and doing, and Christy Tolliver was making big shots. I never looked at them as women's basketball. I looked at it as basketball that happened to be played by women. and it was great basketball.
And you have the title of my book. My book is You Let Some Girl Beat You.
Oh, that's great.
So that is still here.
When did that book come out?
Oh, a few years ago.
We gotta pump that, Bruce. That's a great, what a great title.
But it is in essence.
Oh, look at this.
That guy saying, I don't like women's basketball. And yet Coach Wooden said, women's basketball is more fun to watch because of the fundamentals. And, but you know, whether you're talking about age, so you watch a bunch of 7-year-olds play, whether they're girls or boys, go watch them play basketball, or you watch a bunch of guys that are in their 60s, in pickup games, you go watch them play, whether men or women or your religion or your race or whatever, you know, it shouldn't matter. The game is the game, just like you talked about.
Yeah. Does Diana Taurasi know how good you were?
I don't think any of these players know who I was. But Diana does, because I grew up in Southern California. She's in Southern California.
Yeah, that's true.
Certainly with Cheryl Miller too. But you know, Diana is one of the greatest because of her work ethic.
Yeah.
And her passion and desire for the game. And what sets her apart is that she makes others better. And that's a great player that makes others better.
Yeah.
And she's willing to sacrifice her game, even though she's just got this, which Kobe has called her the white mamba.
Yeah.
She goes at you. And she's 39. Sue Bird is 40. And they're continuing to play. We had a couple gals in our league early on in the WNBA, Helen Darling, who played at Penn mm-hmm. State. She had triplets and came back and played. Taj McWilliams Franklin had two daughters, like 10 to 12 years apart, and she played till the age of 44.
Oh.
And a lot of these women are playing overseas too. So they're playing almost all 12 months out of the year, not like the guys. And yet they're playing into their 40s.
I'm glad that the salary structure changed, and I understand that cost overruns, and everybody's got to be a partner. But I'd like women's basketball to get to a point where you don't have to go to overseas to supplement your income. That would be great.
Yeah, and, I do too, and only play 7 months out of the year.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, no men are, by the way, giving birth taking off, you know, no men do that. It's like,
yeah, Leslie, Candace Parker, Cheryl Swoops.
Oh, no, it's incredible. It's incredible. Does Brittany Griner or Skylar Diggins-Smith, do they come to you for advice at all?
No, not really. No.
You know what? That's sad, because Walt Frazier told me when the Knicks, he would say, like, Walt. Did Charlie wear any? Nah, they don't really know who I am. I go, someone's got to tell them. I don't get that.
And sometimes you feel like you're infringing with the coaches.
Yeah.
Teach, you know, so
but just it's another set of eyes, and it's a person who knows the game. And sort of like my whole thing with my son is I was never good enough to play at a Division I school, but I can tell you things that are going to help you.
And you always want to keep learning. I know I watch as many games as I can to listen to the other announcers.
Yeah.
How they see the game and so forth, just to pick up things.
Do you know who says some crazy things? And I know you know too. Eddie Johnson, one of your broadcast
AJ,
partners.
My bro.
He's great. He's hilarious with Justin Termini.
He and Kevin Ray do a great job. And then when I come in, you know, poor Kevin's got to adjust to my style, which is completely different than Eddie's.
I love Eddie. Eddie could have played till he was 80. He shot so well. And he was like,
he took great care of himself.
He was Ray Allen character in his day, where he just, if you could shoot, you could play for a long time.
That's right.
Well, thanks for being so generous with your time. I hope we can have you on again. And this was just great. For me, it was more of a treat just to go through part of your life and career, but more than that, to hear your thoughts on life. And I feel like it was Ann Myers Drysdale life lessons.
Well, I'm still learning about life. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
Just got to keep getting better every day.
That was dope.
Thanks to my guest, the great Ann Myers Drysdale. Also, thanks to my producer, Bruce Bernstein, who is now going to read some of these promos.
Yeah, Mike, thanks for letting me hog the mic for a minute. Kristen Woolley is our wonderful editor. We say thank you to her as always. And please check out all of our Pure Hoops Media shows. Full Court with Jenny Fisher and Kara Kay has the best in college hoop each Tuesday. Catch and Shoot 2.0 with Otto Strong and Aaron Berlin is here every Wednesday. And last week, they welcomed Tom Haberstroh of True Hoop, and they did a great Utah Jazz breakdown, among other topics. Buckets, Boards, and Blocks with Monica McNutt and King McClure drops each Thursday. And this past week, they discussed Draymond Green's recent comments about NBA double standards between management and labor with our own Dave Wohl, host of Dave's Front Office here at Pure Hoops Media. BJ Armstrong and Eric Newman have the Pure Hoops podcast each Friday. And of course, we have a new Mike Wise show every Monday. We also have a YouTube channel with a ton of great segments you can check out, including Mike's very unplugged conversation with Lakers governor Jeannie Buss. Go to YouTube and search for Pure Hoops Media. Mike?
I do that so much better, Bruce. No, I'm kidding. That was awesome. All right. Hopefully the year 2021 is when we snuff this pandemic out as quickly as possible. When you qualify for the vaccination, please do the right thing. Get it. But until that day arrives, keep your guard up. Wear the mask in public to protect yourselves and others. Wash your hands, keep your distance, be considerate of others, and keep all the medical professionals in your prayers. Till next time, peace.
The Mike Wise Show used to be called The Wise Ass Show, but it remains a presentation of Pure Hoops Media.